We cover many serious issues in this podcast. This discussion may contain reference to domestic violence, sexual violence, violence against children, suicide, drug use, or graphic depictions of death or dead bodies. It is not suitable for all audiences.
Tonight on Unsolved Mysteries Rewind, two friends get together to discuss episodes of their favorite television show, Unsolved Mysteries. Will they find answers? Will anyone care? You may be able to solve a mystery.
Hello, my name is Kim. You are listening to Unsolved Mysteries Rewind, and I am joined, of course, by my co-host, Mark. Mark, how are you?
I'm great, Kim. How are you doing? How's everything?
Really good. Thank you.
You chose a winner of an episode today, Kim. I have to give you the award because this, I don't know, we chose a few episodes, which I'm not going to say they're hit or miss because I enjoy pretty much all of these episodes, but wow, do you hear my Long Island accent kicking right there? All of these episodes. So I really, really loved this episode for some reason. It really resonated. It had everything that an Unsolved Mysteries fan would want.
And a whole lot of updates and juicy updates. So our first one is a story that I've heard about for a long, long time. And I've got a lot of this information from not only Wikipedia and the Unsolved Mysteries Wikipedia, but I also got this from reading case file upon affidavit, like all the court paperwork.
This is a pretty popular case, and it really seems to resonate a lot, but it doesn't have a lot of popularity. Like, you could probably ask somebody about this case and they'll have no idea, but there seems to be a lot written about it.
Yeah, so we're talking of the disappearance, really, of Ashley Freeman and her best friend, Laura Bible. This takes place December 29th, 1999 in Welch, Oklahoma. And Ashley is having a small little birthday party. It's her 16th birthday. She's joined by her parents, her boyfriend, and her best friend, Laura Bible. And Laura is actually spending the night that night. So the boyfriend leaves at like 9:30 at night. And during the night, the house caught fire.
I had the number one, I had the question of whether it was a house or a trailer that she stayed in. And I think some people say, well, who cares? But I think it does care because I feel like a trailer would go up quicker.
Yeah. And this whole episode is called Trailer Terror.
Yeah. But when they're kind of going through the wreckage, I guess different trailer parks could have different things, like different setups. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I didn't get the impression that this was a trailer. I got the impression that this was a standard, regular house.
It definitely looks like one in the Unsolved Mysteries, but every report I read said mobile home. So kind of splitting the difference there.
Yeah.
At 5:30 in the next morning on December 30th, 1999, firefighters respond to the reports of the fire and they extinguish it. So at 8 a.m., Laura's parents arrive and they are terrified because the house that their daughter was staying at is like ashes, basically, at this point. Notice that Laura and everybody's cars are still in the driveway. So the coroner's there. The coroner says, look, we've looked all over the property. We found one body and it actually belongs to Kathy Freeman. And Kathy Freeman is Ashley's mom. So it's Kathy's house. The coroner said, like, Kathy actually died of a gunshot wound to the head and the fire was deliberately set. So
this whole thing is crazy.
Yeah.
You know, like, When you start talking about that, one thing that occurred to me that nobody really discussed, and I feel like they really kind of glared over it in the reenactment, is that this took place in the dead of winter in Oklahoma, where it's pretty harsh winter, usually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But we're kind of looking at it like it's fall.
Hmm.
And I'm wondering if it had something to do, I'm sure you're going to talk about the oversights that will come out after the investigation.
Oh, my God.
But I was just trying to figure out this major oversight, and I have to wonder, maybe it was just really harsh out, and they just rushed through it. I'm not sure. I'm always trying to look for a humane reason for not doing something.
I mean, I definitely think that this was a rush job, no doubt about it. But also, you know, it's a small town police force. I'm sure they're not really super used to this kind of thing. In the 1990s, Welch, Oklahoma, and this was on the outskirts of Welch near a town called Veneta, but Welch had 500 some odd residents at the time. So I'm sure it was just like a, they're not used to this kind of thing.
Especially on New Year's Eve, practically.
Yeah, so exactly. I'm sure they're all ready to go home. But it's horrible because authorities at this point are thinking, okay, we only have one body. It's the mom. So the dad must have killed the mom and taken the girls and kidnapped them.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was watching, you probably, of course, you knew the case. So, but I didn't. So I'm watching it. I'm like, well, obviously, he kidnapped the girls and that's that. That's the end.
You know, I mean,
let's
like
move on to the next story.
The true crime thing. The husband always did it, does it. The husband always does it, you know. But
that's the dopiest thing of all time.
I know. Well, the day after the fire, the Bibles, the parents, they return to the scene and they're just combing through the wreckage to find what they can find. And within 5 minutes of searching, they find the body of the father. Like,
and that's where I think every viewer goes, wait, what?
5 minutes of searching, they found a whole body that the coroner missed.
Two things, though.
Yeah.
Well, actually, it's three major things here. They go to see if they can find anything through the wreckage, mm-hmm. right? Which just makes me think, you have to really have a certain lack of respect for your law enforcement if you are going to go and do this, and even if you're able to do this, right?
Good point.
Two, you find them. You find something. Mm-hmm. Not, you didn't just find, you know, a note or, you know, some type of little piece of evidence. You find a corpse.
Mm-hmm.
And three, his face is blown off.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, I couldn't imagine being in that situation, finding it and seeing the level of incompetency.
I know. And these poor parents must be so traumatized. Anybody stumbling upon a burnt body while searching for the charred body of their own daughter, you know, and they find this.
It's your kid, right?
Yeah.
It's your kid until they confirm it's not.
Exactly. And they said that this person had from the top row of teeth all the way to the top of his head was gone because he obviously suffered a gunshot wound to the head. So we find that it is an adult male. It is Danny Freeman, who had been shot with a shotgun, which will, like, destroy your face. But the parents also find Laura's purse with her driver's license in it, mm-hmm. and almost $200 cash. So
isn't that a lot of cash, in your opinion,
I mean,
for a 16-year-old?
Yeah, I guess
I don't know.
So.
Maybe holiday time. I mean, it could be just, you know, it was a good Christmas for her, and she got a bunch of gifts. Mm. And she's like, let's go buy some Jägermeister.
Yeah, that checks out. I mean, yeah, totally.
That's pretty true.
That's what I would have done at 16. But so Ashley's boyfriend, Jeremy, who was there that night, said, like, he left at 9:30 and everything's fine. So we get a little bit of a backstory through Danny, the father's brother, Dwayne Vansell. And he says that 3 months before the murder, Danny told Dwayne, the brother, listen, Dwayne, if anything should ever happen to me, you need to take a look at the sheriff's department. So the sheriff's department in this town, it's rumored that they're kind of feuding with the Freeman family. And I'm not going to lie, the Freeman family sounds like a little bit of trouble, to be honest with you. Still doesn't mean that a murder investigation shouldn't be done properly, but it definitely sounds like they have had their fair share of run-ins with the police. Well, not only is Danny the father rumored in this town to be like a low-level meth dealer, but the son Shane, this is when it kind of all came to a head. Son Shane was shot and killed by a deputy after Shane had stolen a truck and a neighbor's gun.
Now, what's interesting about this is they revealed this because we're looking at it and we're watching and we're seeing family photos. And I'm like, well, who the hell is this guy?
Mm-hmm. You know,
nobody's talking about this kid. Yeah. And I'm thinking, all right, what they're going to reveal is that this guy is the killer.
Nope.
But no.
Nope. He just died at the deputy's hands. And it was ruled a justifiable shooting, which, I mean, you stole a gun. Like, cops aren't going to take that super lightly.
Yeah, you can't steal a truck and be armed and expect to not come out with a problem. And it sounds as though he wasn't really willing to give himself up. I'm not really sure what the situation is, but I really got the vibe that Unsolved Mysteries did not want to side with law enforcement during this time.
Yeah, and I
sometimes I think they like to push the incompetence of law enforcement.
I do too, and let's be honest, if there was ever a case that deserved it, it's this one. But I also think that they're just kind of like leaving all avenues open for us, because it is like very reasonable to think that maybe a deputy might have had something to do with it. So the Freemans actually threatened to file a wrongful death suit against the sheriff's department. And at this point,
I know I keep interrupting you. I'm so sorry. Do we know? I tried to find a number of people who are on the police staff, and I couldn't. Did you happen to find anything like
No, I didn't.
Yeah, I just couldn't. I should have asked you, but
yeah, I didn't even think to.
I wonder if it's like, you know, Hazard County, where it's like, you know, five people or something.
I mean, there's 500 people in this town. Yeah. So
I mean, this isn't the 80s or 70s either. This is. Is this 99?
Yep.
When this is all going on? So, I mean, it's 20 years ago, but at the same time, it's a relatively modern society with computers and everything. I just kind of find it interesting. I'm just, and like you said, it's a population of 500 people-ish. Yep. So you're not going to have a huge arsenal of people, but at the same time, I would just be curious, well, how many, you know, how many people?
Yeah, and I'm sure he probably, like, went to high school with some of these people. Like, I'm sure they all know each other outside of this. Yeah. But after this...
It's like Copland, if you ever saw that movie with... have you ever seen Copland?
No.
See Copland. It's a great movie with Sylvester Stallone, believe it or not. It's an art film. Just see it. It gives you kind of, like, police corruption in New Jersey in a small town like this. It probably is based loosely off of true stories.
Probably. But... after, like, this whole wrongful death lawsuit thing, the sheriff's deputies, quote, embarked on a campaign of intimidation. So Dwayne tells Unsolved Mysteries that Danny told him that the officer was like, I can do whatever I want to you and your family, and you can't do nothing about it. So after the murders, the sheriff's department was like, look, we have too much of a history with this family. We're going to turn it over to the State Bureau of Investigations, which, good for them. That's the absolute right move. The deputies all were given polygraphs and they passed. And according to an informant, 2 weeks before the murders, Danny Freeman, the father, met with two unidentified men, quote, one of whom was clearly unwelcomed. So the sheriffs are beginning to think, wait, we can find both them. We can't find the girls. I wonder if Ashley murdered her parents and ran off with Laura. It's definitely a possibility. Yeah.
There's so much weirdness going on. And it seems like people are just not willing to talk either. People know what the situation is. And you were saying you keep on seeing a lot of stuff written about meth. And there actually is a book written about this story called Hell in the Heartland by Penguin Random House. And yeah, I mean, there's a subtitle, which... I'm going to give you the subtitle in a second if it will just load, but it's Hell in the Heartland by Jax Miller, Murder, Meth, and the Case of Two Missing Girls. So meth had definitely something to do with it. There was some evidence there. I don't think meth was really on the radar of Unsolved Mysteries at the time.
No, it wasn't. But what I can tell, this whole thing was like an open secret in town. Pretty much everybody knew who did it and everything. It's just, why wasn't anything done about it? So... we leave Unsolved Mysteries with the parents being like, we want the girls back. I just want to know if they're dead or alive. Like, if they both want to come back, I'll raise them both. Like, oh, the parents just really want the girls back. The Bibles.
They seem like decent people, actually. Yes. I've kind of got a real, like, they're pretty nice people vibe.
Yeah. And, you know, in 2010, still no word from the girls. And the Freeman family took steps to have Ashley declared legally dead. Now, we have an update. A lot of this info is extra stuff on Unsolved Mysteries Rewind exclusive. I mean, not exclusive, what? But it wasn't on Unsolved Mysteries. So a few like awful people have falsely confessed to killing the family and disposing of the girls' bodies because it got them like out of prison for a time. They got to have visits with their lawyer, like all that horrible stuff. But on April 26th of 2018, witness tips led to the arrest of 66-year-old Ronnie Dean Busick. And he has a profile on Facebook. Again, we don't support harassing people, but, I mean, He's like flipping off the camera and his thing. He just is gross. So
yeah, I thought he was pretty classy in that photo.
Yeah. And he's with like his son or grandson or something too. So who's also flipping off the camera. But witnesses claim that Busick, who is along with now deceased suspects, Warren Philip Welch Jr. and David Pennington, bragged about raping and murdering Laura and Ashley, and they even took photographs of the girls bound and gagged with duct tape lying on a bed. There were about 10 to 15 Polaroids taken of the girls, and some with Warren Philip Welch, who's like the mastermind, laying next to them, and some with the girls duct taped.
Now, is that a fact?
Yes, it is.
The Polaroids are a fact.
There's over a dozen witnesses that testify to the fact that he always carried it in this like leather briefcase, and he just like loved having these photos. The photos have not been found, but 12 witnesses individually have said that.
I just, you know, when I think of Polaroids, I don't think of 1999 or even having access to that kind of film at the time.
But you're not going to want to go get that developed.
Well, you don't get it developed. Polaroids are instant.
No, I know. So I'm just saying you wouldn't want to go take disposable photos and get that developed and then the cops calling you.
No, but what I'm saying is I don't think that they had instant cameras at this point. I think they had been phased out by now.
Oh, I grew up with Polaroids and stuff. They're old.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'm wrong, man.
I'm sure it's like probably an old Polaroid. I don't think it's like a 1999 brand new Polaroid, but I'm sure that they had it. I definitely have shaken my fair share of Polaroids, which I know you're not supposed to. But several witnesses claim that
I'm wrong.
Freemans were killed over drug money and that the girls were raped and tortured for several days in Welch's trailer before being murdered and, according to the affidavit, by strangulation. So
it's like worst case scenario coming out.
Yeah, horrible. Happy birthday to poor little Ashley, who just turned 16. It's absolutely horrifying.
I forgot about that already at this point. Wow.
I'm so glad these girls at least had each other there. Hopefully they were able to find some comfort with knowing the other one was there. But the witnesses also claim that Busick allegedly disposed of the girls' remains in either a mine shaft in Pitcher, Oklahoma, or in a root cellar, which was later covered with concrete. So something else that ties Welch, the mastermind guy, to the crime scene was that in the rubble, there was a business card of Welch's girlfriend, and the girls' bodies have never been found. So this is where the case becomes very much like in the now.
Like really in the now, as of like weeks ago.
As of like 2 weeks ago when we record this. It's so crazy. But Busick is charged with 4 counts of first-degree murder, 2 counts of kidnapping, 1 count of arson. So in July 2020... Busick accepted a plea deal to plead guilty to first-degree murder on the conditions that he produced the girls' bodies before August 31st of 2020. If the girls' bodies are recovered, the plea states that he is only to spend 5 years in prison for murdering.
What kind of deal? What kind of amazing attorney does this guy have to make this kind of deal?
Well, I'll tell you what it is. It's the Bibles. It's the parents saying, bring our daughter home, bring our daughter. We don't even care what happens. Just bring our daughter home. Because the victim's families have to sign off on plea deals before they can accept it. The bad guys can accept it. So I guarantee you that's all that it is. But he is like, and it's a circumstantial case, you know, so I don't know. It's crazy that you can get 5 years in prison for murdering 4 people premeditatedly, kidnapping, raping 2 girls, and then, you know, setting fire to the house.
But at the same time, the bodies were not recovered.
Well, he actually, and again, this is all like within weeks ago, he took them. I guess a lot of this town is like destitute. A lot of the trailers that were there are no longer there. So he couldn't find where he thought the root cellar was. They dug and they dug and they dug and they didn't find the girls' bodies. They also not drained, but searched with like penetrating radar a bunch of the mines to try and find where the girls' bodies were. Because the deadline passed in August of 2020, he was sentenced to 10 years in prison and 5 years probation.
Which is still very light.
Crazy.
But I guess that is also because there's no body.
Yeah, but there's 2 bodies. I
mean, it's weird.
Yeah.
It's weird. You get, if the bodies were recovered, you get less.
Well, I think.
Strange.
Yeah. And I think a lot of this has to do with the fact that it's circumstantial. And guess who your witnesses are? A bunch of meth heads. You know, like, I think that it's just not a strong case. And the prosecutor's like, any guilty verdict is a verdict, you know, and I'll take it. It's a win for me. So I don't know. But the 33-page affidavit is available on Tulsa World Online. It has a lot of, like, the witness interviews. Very interesting. But a witness A witness in the affidavit states that Welch and Pennington would refer to Laura and Ashley as, quote, those two little bitches who would still be alive if they hadn't taken off running from their vehicles. And it's worth. And
you found a fact that was chilling to me, I thought, and about the key.
Yeah.
So if you could share that, because when I read that, that really, really got me very upset, actually.
In Laura's car that was found at the burnt down house, the keys were in the ignition. And I just can't help thinking about her running away and almost getting away. You know, just, oh, she was so close. It makes me so
like
sad.
Pulled out. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
But again, there is a book out there called Hell in the Heartland. I don't know. I don't know if it's any good. It has a picture of the burning house on, or trailer on the front. Mm-hmm. Or a burning trailer. But all in all, it's a pretty sad story that we don't really get any resolution from, except we find out that Ronnie was sentenced to 10 additional years, really?
10 years which in is really prison, five. 5 years probation, which, I mean, he is not the pinnacle of health. I'm sure he won't even live that long. But, I mean, beyond the fact that we can't find these two girls' bodies and these parents are still out there every day, you know, trying to raise hope for finding them. Two of the suspects are dead. Like, they didn't suffer anything. And like I said, this was an open secret in the town. Everybody knew about this, about the pictures, about everything. And so if action was taken immediately, at least David Pennington would have gotten in trouble because he just died in like 2017. So it's just a bummer. Yeah. But we have another bummer, lost in Jamaica.
This is a fun story. And I just thought it was really interesting and kind of a big reenactment, I'd say, for Unsolved Mysteries. We have New York-based writers, travel writers, which I totally missed the first time I watched this. Because I was wondering, they're traveling to Cuba. And to travel to Cuba used to be such a big deal. You wouldn't be able to just travel directly to Cuba unless you were press or what they're doing, which is travel writing.
Right. And this is in May of 2000. So this was definitely when Cuba was like off limits.
Yeah, definitely. So she's two people are traveling, Claudia Kershaw and Tania Grossinger. And their Cuban trip is canceled. So they find themselves stranded in Jamaica after they were on their way to Havana, which I would personally just love to go to.
Yeah, I think it sounds really cool. But they, like, couldn't even get a trip back to New York. This is on May 24th. They find out that they're stranded while they're in Jamaica. And they can't even get a trip back until the earliest June 1st back to New York. So they're like...
Do we know why that it was canceled? Was it weather or...
I don't know why it was canceled. No, I don't know why it was canceled. Yeah. But they're like, well, I guess we're going to spend a week in Jamaica. And so the whole press trip was brought to you by, like, Sandals Resort. And so Sandals Resort actually sends them to Negril, Jamaica, and there they're going to be put up at a Sandals Resort until they can get a ticket back home.
Which makes total sense. You know, none of this seems like kind of shady. It's a pretty common trip. You know, a lot of people do it all the time. But so we speak to Tania, who is, she's just like, I think she's still in the business. And she says that they couldn't go to Havana. So they were told that they were also told that they couldn't go to New York. We already covered that. I'm sorry. So they arrive at Jamaica on May 24th, and all the trips to New York were booked until June 1st. Claudia was hired as the editor. Not really hired, but maybe she went up into become the editor of Frommer's Travel Guides, which is a pretty big travel guide. I'm sure you've seen it around. It's kind of... And to get an editor job for such a large publication is such a big deal. So I really think she's really kind of going up the ladder of like this corporate.
She's only 29.
You know, she's young.
Yeah.
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 No, you can go on.
No, so I was just going to say, so while she's there, she disappears without a trace and she has never been seen again. So we meet our parents, Fred and Marianne Kershaw. They race to Negril as soon as they learn that she's missing. And when the trip was canceled, like we said, Sandals put the women up in a hotel in Negril. And they didn't even know each other before this whole trip. So they're like kind of getting to know each other and just chill like Jamaican style. So Claudia made friends, quote unquote, with a bartender at Sandals named Anthony Grant. And the next morning she told Tanya, she's like, Anthony and I had a great night. Like, we smoked some dope and we went skinny dipping. Right. And I am just here for that Jamaica living.
But that's it. You know, like, this is really, you know, they're on vacation.
Yeah.
It's what the tourists do. It's what the locals do.
If you ask me, it's like a Jamaican.
I personally have never been there. I've never been there, but I have friends who go, and that's exactly what they do. You know, it's crazy.
Yeah. So for some reason, there was like some kind of cancellation or something. So Tanya was actually able to book a trip home to New York on May 27th. So Claudia is now by herself in Negril, Jamaica. And they're like, we are good friends now. We're going to meet up in New York City when Claudia comes back home. So later that day, she is never seen from again. She is reportedly last seen by a lifeguard walking along the beach away from the resort. And she's in like a bathing suit. She has a little radio.
It. Yeah. Yeah. And she basically disappears. And from what I understand, the water, and we get this confirmed later, you can't really, there aren't any like riptides or, you know, you don't think of Jamaica as a place where you get swept into the ocean.
Right.
You know, it's just the way that the area is kind of exists is just not really storm crazy. You know, like they have storms, but it's when it's nice out, it's beautiful out. Mm-hmm. And there's no accidental thing. Not to say it couldn't happen. She could have drowned and could have. I don't know what kind of, like, do they have sharks there? I'm not really sure.
I mean, I don't think on, like, the Sandals Resort little carved out little kiddie pool beach they have sharks there, you know, but
maybe.
It's possible. I've never been, but the hotel maids are cleaning her stuff and they're like, nothing has moved in a while. So they contact Sandals. Sandals contacts her parents Sandals doesn't contact her parents. Frommer's, the travel guide company, they contact her parents on June 2nd and are like, she was supposed to start this super important job and she hasn't shown up yet. So they go to Jamaica. We find that everything was packed away neatly in her suitcase except for a bathing suit. And in the hotel safe was her passport, her cell phone, all her cash.
It's definitely shady. I mean, it also, with the cash staying behind and all of these things, it also doesn't have the inkling of being robbed.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So at Sandals,
maybe just abducted.
Yeah. Right. But at Sandals, all license plates are entering and leaving are recorded in a logbook.
Oh, that's awesome. That's what we need right now. So what did that say?
But that logbook for the month that she went missing has disappeared and cannot be found. There's also
crazy.
It's so shady. It's so suspicious. And it's not like it was like, oh, that one from 4 years ago, we don't have it anymore. No, it's like the one from 3 days ago when it was May. It's crazy.
Right. And if the reenactment is anything like reality, it's just a loose leaf piece of paper that they're writing on. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like yank, crumple, burn, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there's a security camera near Claudia's room that had already been recorded over, which you and I both agree is not super uncommon back in 1990 or, you know, in 2000 when it was probably on like a VHS tape anyway.
And these are special VCRs that record on a regular standard 2 hour videotape, and it records super slow, and it records like a 12-hour thing, and each person's shift, you would swap tapes probably.
Yeah.
And you would do it until the tapes wore out, and you would keep probably 14 tapes for a week, and that would be it. You'd be covered for a week.
And now...
what else? You know.
Yeah, sorry. We should probably...
No, it's just... Go on.
Sorry. We should probably cite The Trail Went Cold here. That is a podcast. It's awesome. They cover a lot of cases that are covered on Unsolved Mysteries, and we got a lot of info from there. So I just want to give credit where credit's due. But because it's a hotel, they cleaned a room. They processed it. You know, before it could be processed, they cleaned a room. New people were staying there already. Like, they just tried to kind of sweep this under the rug. And also later, mysteriously, her cell phone disappears out of evidence. So
I also just point out one thing.
Yeah.
I've stayed at a lot of different hotels and different resorts and stuff. The fact that the money was still there, you know, and all this stuff is such, like, they should get like a 5-star Yelp review for that. Or Travelocity, because you know, you have cash there, you know, and the maids are kind of coming in and cleaning it. It's just one of these things that if you know the person's kind of missing, you just grab the cash, I guess. Oh. If you're a shady, you know, company.
Yeah.
But I have to give them credit for not robbing her.
Yeah, except for the cell phone.
So that's what we hear, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, later the cell phone disappears, right?
Right, but I don't know. I don't like sandals after reading all this. We do meet Detective Denver Frater, and you spotted a funny typo because they spelled Jamaica wrong on the title card for him.
Yeah, I don't, J-A-I, I believe.
Yeah, J-A-I, Maka, but he is the one who says, like, it's possible that she drowned, but it's not very probable. So a lot of local residents say they saw Claudia out and about, and she just took with an island lover, and she is just, you know, they show her, like, eating
mango.
Exactly, eating mangoes, like, off the trees, and just being like, everything's Irie. Like, she's Michael Scott when he comes back from Sandals Resort in Jamaica.
She's exactly Michael Scott, because she goes to shake one of the locals' hands.
Oh, my God.
You know, like, kind of giving the soul brother handshake, and he just kind of says, yeah, okay.
Yeah, he totally
and
leaves
it's
her
really
hanging.
Funny to watch, I think.
Yeah, in the reenactment, she tries to, like, fist bump him after, and he's just like, I'm going to go back to petting this dog. But
exactly.
There's a really shady, allegedly, Sandals public relation manager named Leo Lambert, and he allegedly held a press conference in which he describes her as just, like, this wild party girl who just ran away with her Jamaican lover. So they are already starting to kind of try to tarnish her reputation and shift some of the blame onto herself. But there's no evidence to prove that this is true. Claudia's parents enlist the FBI and U.S. search and rescue teams. So they get this dog, and the dog traces the scent of Claudia to the home of Anthony Grant, the bartender from earlier who she went skinny dipping with. And the dog reportedly hit on a pair of boots, a pair of gloves, and a quote-unquote knife. I mean, technically it's a knife.
Oh, my God, a knife?
Yeah.
A huge, like, a knife, right? What did it look like?
It was like a multi-tool. It was like a big Swiss Army knife, basically.
Yeah. I will say it was a large version of the Leatherman multi-tool, but it was just, it's a pocket knife. I mean, that's all that is.
It's probably like 1 inch tall, the actual knife by like 4 inches long at most. Which, I mean, yeah. I'm sure you probably could kill somebody that way, but it's not my go-to murder weapon. That sounded bad.
It's great for whittling a piece of wood, maybe.
Yeah,
maybe.
Exactly. But apparently there's blood on the knife. They take samples, but the DNA is inconclusive. So the dog also picks up Claudia's scent in the backseat and the trunk of the car. And supposedly,
now, did you say in the past on a previous episode that dogs are also not 100% accurate?
Yeah, definitely.
Or the inaccuracy is pretty high.
Yeah, definitely. It's a dog, and the bloodhound evidence I know in, like, California is either inadmissible or taken with a big old grain of salt.
Because it's just weird when we talk about polygraphs, which we will talk about in just a few minutes. I think you and I really dismiss polygraphs. We just think, oh my God, it's like a magic trick almost. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, I think that the public puts so much more faith in canines. Mm-hmm. You know, like bomb sniffing dogs and stuff like that, which I think I can side with. But the scent thing, I don't know. It just doesn't make so much sense to me.
There's at least two cases that we've covered that come to the top of my mind where a cadaver dog hit, which means there's a body there at some point. But where's the body now? Like, was there really a cadaver there at some point? We don't know. We're taking this dog's word for it. And I'm sure it depends on their handler and how they're trained and all that stuff.
Yeah, I'm just curious. Like, if you bought, like, a steak, right, and left it in your in the back of your car and it leaked. You know, I wonder, will that trigger it? Maybe. I'm just throwing it out there. I know nothing about this type of thing, but it's something maybe I'll do a little research and try to figure out. But
okay,
I
awesome.
Love dogs. I think we all love dogs and we want it to be true. But I just don't know if I can buy into it so much.
Yeah. And, you know, supposedly the FBI found some of Claudia's hairs in the back seat. But if you have a little vacation fling and maybe you're fooling around in the back seat, I mean, I could see. I'm not saying that he didn't kill her, but I'm just saying I could also see it getting there from that. So they discussed.
As my hair has gotten long again, whenever I put it up in, like, you know, put it up or something, my hair ends up everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so it's just one of those things where it's, you know, that's just you have long hair and it gets everywhere. It gets on your bathroom floor. It gets everywhere. So, yeah, I can't really accept that as solid concrete evidence that he killed her.
Right, but it all goes towards building a case. And that's all it comes down to at the end of the day is building a case. And also, they discovered that his seat covers had recently been changed. So they set Anthony Grant up with a polygraph. The polygraph results came back inconclusive. Now, someone on unsolved.com claims that they were the polygrapher, but I call BS because it's online and you can lie about anything.
Yeah. Like, what are you doing here?
Yeah.
You know, like, what are you doing on this website if that's so true?
Exactly. So here's what I found out. He failed one polygraph. He was asked if he knew Claudia Hirschog, and he said no. Now, when he was called out that he failed it, he said that he lied because the hotel has a policy from, like, staff gallivanting around with guests. So most of his polygraph, he failed, actually, but he passed on the question of, did you kill Claudia? And his answer was no. So he is no longer considered a suspect in Claudia's disappearance. Tanya, who we were talking about earlier, Tanya, suspects that he knows more than he's letting on, which, yeah, I would say so. So the last time she was seen was May 27th of 2000. To me, this seems like a sex trafficking case. She's a beautiful woman. She's a vulnerable tourist alone by herself in a different country. I could totally see her being taken away by somebody.
Really? And I'm not saying that that's not definitely plausible. It's just very often we'll see a lot of like Russian women who just want to get out of Russia and they want to come and live a better life, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's like they're desperate for it. Why take some loudmouth white woman with a career, you know, who's smart enough to probably get away, actually. Maybe not, actually. But I don't know. I just think if they're going to sex trafficking, there has to be some type of, at some point, they have to go along with it.
Well, usually they're, like, drugged all the time. You know, it's just, it's Stockholm syndrome after a while. I mean, you just are trapped in this own invisible bar prison because all these people have told you for so long you are trapped, you know, just in general with sex trafficking. But apparently sex
I don't know much about the adult thing, but yeah, like, as you wrote in the notes, it's really children who are so trafficked and that whole dark aspect of all, not just Jamaica, of course, it's everywhere.
Well, apparently in Jamaica, it's a huge problem, sex trafficking, but it is mostly poor native Jamaican children who are trafficked. So Claudia was legally declared dead in May of 2002. And here's just something to think about. The day after she disappeared, the bartender, Anthony Grant, called out of work sick and missed the next 4 days of work. Now, Leo Lambert, the Sandals PR rep guy who held that press conference, he also took the same 4 days off from work and hastily tried to obtain a new passport on very short notice. So,
oh, that's interesting.
Lambert admitted that he tried to paint Claudia as a runaway in order to protect the resort's reputation and to save his job, because what's going to kill tourism faster than a pretty white, excuse me for saying it, but that's what they're thinking, tourist who goes disappearing, and then all these people aren't going to come and visit now because they won't return home, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So in June of 2001, the Kershaws, the parents, receive an anonymous letter which stated that Claudia had gone to a party with Anthony Grant where he slipped her the date rape drug, which actually overdosed her, caused her to go into convulsions and die, which is very, this whole thing is very Natalie Holloway.
Yeah, you made a few correlations between that case and this case. And where did the Natalie Holloway case happen?
Aruba.
I know it was the Caribbean.
Aruba.
Aruba, okay.
The Kershaws filed a lawsuit against Sandals Resort, which alleged that the employees from Beaches Negril withheld information about what happened to Claudia and destroyed evidence in order to impede the investigation. And the two sides reached a confidential settlement in 2007.
Yeah, we were going to go to Jamaica a couple years ago, and my wife just something like this kind of comes up more often than not lately. In the past, like, 10 years or so, my wife was just like, you know what? How about no? How about we just not go into this? And then, I don't know. I feel as though there's a lot of people who go there and they hang with the locals and they get maybe mixed up into things that they don't need to really, they shouldn't be getting mixed up into.
I mean, tourists are easy people to pick off, let's be honest. You know, just like with Natalie Holloway, you're in a strange land. You got that, like, I'm on vacation, maybe have a few drinks kind of vibe, you know, and you're just.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
I don't like the way they were kind of, I feel as though they were painting a little bit of a picture of a girl gone wild. And I think she was just a girl on vacation. Personally.
I do too.
And a single girl. You know, she's single. She can do whatever the hell she wants. She's an adult, mm-hmm. a girl, woman. But it's just, you know, I didn't really care for that so much. But all in all, I think maybe she just kind of got wrapped up into something. It doesn't scream to me sex trafficking, but, you know, anything is possible.
Yeah, I mean, it just, there's another case, Amy Lynn Bradley, and she got sex trafficked allegedly off this, like, cruise ship, and it was just giving me vibes of her, too. I know Natalie Holloway supposedly got overdosed on GHB by Jorn Vandersloot, and they had to bury her on the beach, and I know that's supposedly what happened to her, but it just, it's sad that there's more than one story that we can reference about this kind of thing, but... Something I didn't particularly care for is this next segment, Ghost Boy from Manchester, Connecticut.
Grandpa Pierce appears.
Yeah.
So Denise Jones hears her son Michael screaming for her, and she runs up to see that he's afraid, and he's petrified, actually. I would have liked to see the actual Michael showing these type of emotions,
because
when we finally do see Michael, he's... It's pretty cold, like it's pretty cardboardish.
Yeah, and he doesn't open his mouth a lot when he talks. And he's
doesn't
just very,
move his lips at all.
Just super wooden, like just not super into it. And I have a theory about that.
but he told his mom that he saw a ghost of a man in his bedroom, and he had been seeing ghosts since he was 5 years old, allegedly. Michael was visiting his grandparents' house again, and he just started screaming, saying that he saw the man again when he saw. A picture that ended up being a photograph of his grandfather who he had never met. I forget how many years he had passed. I know they mention it, but
I don't even know if they do mention it, but it was the mom's grandfather. So it was his great grandfather.
Oh, his great grandfather. I didn't catch that. Mm-hmm. Sorry. So it was the great grandfather and you see a photograph of him. It doesn't look creepy. Really. He just looks like a regular old guy. And
he looked nice,
but he had never met him. Yeah, he seemed like kind of guys like, hey, here's $5, go buy yourself some bologna. Mm-hmm. So, so I don't know. My grandfather gave me money for weird things. So when thing is that Michael believed he had been a recurring thing. He had been seeing a lot of different ghosts. We don't know if it was the same ghosts that he was seeing since he was 5 years old. I don't think they really point that out.
Right,
but he does say that. The picture of this one particular man is the one that he saw. He starts screaming, which I just think is kind of strange. I don't think we're supposed to assume he's a little bit older at this point, I think. Maybe like 12?
Yeah, at the oldest.
But he's very upset over this photograph, but they determine that it is his great-grandfather, as you said. Michael claims to have spoken with the great-grandpa and... said that good spirits and evil spirits are fighting over his soul, which of course is something that would scare the hell out of any kid or anyone in general. Denise, who claims to be a skeptic, she had never believed in this stuff at all. She hired a paranormal specialist named John Zaffis, who's still around. He's still doing investigation. If you look him up on Facebook, you see he's reminding people to wear their mask. And he's been doing this for decades and he's spent quite a number of hours. It says hundreds of hours. Whenever I see that, I'm just like, what are you talking about? But spent hundreds of hours with the Jones family trying to determine exactly what's going on. Michael had been submitted for neurological determination. We don't really get an outcome to the neurological.
No, they literally said that the hospital people were like, what can we tell you? He's a ghost boy. He sees ghosts. I was like, no hospital told you that.
Yeah, that didn't happen. But, you know, maybe Dr. John Zaffis did. I don't know if he's a doctor. But I think maybe if they did say that, they were like, well, look, he just has a crazy imagination. You know, this. What year did this happen? Do we have a year?
I am going to guess 1999.
99? Yeah. So it's not the period of time where they're really pushing Adderall or is Adderall the right thing?
What's
the one where Ritalin? I'm sorry, Adderall. Pushing Adderall on a 10-year-old. No, but Ritalin to kind of focus kids, it wasn't in such a big push for at least another 5 or 6 years. So nowadays, you know, it's the first thing that they'll basically prescribe if a kid has an over, like just a crazy imagination. But Michael's claiming to have been seeing menacing shadow men, and there's just no real outcome as to whether he ever had to take medication. Right.
Just holy water.
We do learn that holy water. We do learn that when he was a baby, though, he had several near-death experiences, which we've spoken about in the past, where sometimes near-death experiences can trigger psychic or paranormal existence in your life. And I don't know, but he was a very sickly child, and it possibly pushed him onto the edge of the spirit world. He was in a situation where his bed started moving on its own. I mean, we're talking, I don't know. There doesn't seem to be a lot of evidence, or if any evidence, that any of this stuff is actually going on and that it's outside of imagination.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a hard time really buying into it. I think you did as well. He
yes.
did get a few scratches. He doesn't come off as somebody who's exactly excited about this happening
right.
to him. You know, I just kind of get that vibe that it's just you're kind of repeating what you've been told, and not
exactly.
to call somebody out for it. I just and you did a bit of research and you did find that Denise may have had her hand in maybe steering, seeing a weird shadow like I see every once in a while to something much bigger and I guess something that's sellable.
You know, I don't mind calling people out at all. But Denise is like, she just so happens to have a book on Michael that she is pitching during this Unsolved Mysteries. On her Facebook currently, she's like, I'm a paranormal investigator. And I found Michael's Facebook because they do give him a fake name on this show. I found his Facebook in real life, and he wants nothing to do with the ghost boy image. He is just like trying to live his life, and he has had a troubled life. And when you see him on Unsolved Mysteries, it looks like he's just like, am I done yet? Like, did I lie about this enough?
I just want to go home and... Yeah, I want to go listen to Korn or something.
Yes, he totally wanted to go home and listen to Korn. That's why I guess 1999, because every boy when I was young had that same haircut with like the spiked bangs only, you know?
But, yeah, with the choker necklace.
Yeah, and so his mom subjects him to 4 different exorcisms within a year. They force him to drink holy water. Like, they're going to have to do a house exorcism. They moved all over the place. His mom... This is not part of it, but at 34 minutes and 12 seconds, his mom is holding hands with him and kisses him on the lips.
No. They both kiss each other on the lips.
Yeah,
they both leaned into each other.
Now, they look like a couple.
I don't know how your family is or the people who are listening. I just personally think that parent and child mouth kissing is just not comfortable to me.
I don't mind, like, you're kissing your 2-year-old. You know, a baby.
He leaned in and tilted his head.
Yeah. Yeah. When you got the tilt, when your kid is like prepubescent, maybe don't like make out with him on TV. Like, it was weird.
Right. Well, he had to do something for those Korn concert tickets.
It was gross. It was all gross. Yeah. This whole thing was just, ugh.
But yeah, I don't know if I buy into the 4 exorcisms. I don't know who did these exorcisms. Were these... was this through Catholicism? They didn't really come off as very religious people. I think the Catholic Church would just dismiss this immediately, especially in 1999, in the height of like the Marilyn Manson movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he looked the part, like you said, the Korn tickets. But I do want to say, too, I found his Facebook, and he looks like he's just trying to do his best. You know what? He is a dad. He is married. He is working hard. And he seems like a really sensitive guy, to be honest with you. But I would be remiss to not say that he has quite the past with law enforcement. To be fair, this last charge was in 2011, but he has a ton of charges. Larceny, harassment, narcotics, minor in possession, and promoting prostitution.
Now, did this all happen in, do you know if he moved a lot I know they moved a lot of different houses, but did he move like a lot around the country or?
Not really.
I'm trying to, yeah. I mean, so this all happened. Probably got a bad reputation. Oh, Connecticut. That's where it took place. Mm-hmm. Probably just got stuck in Connecticut like a lot of people do. And, you know, got a reputation, got caught doing everything.
And I mean, do you know how embarrassing this would be for you to go on TV as like 11 or 12 year old boy, not only kissing your mom on the mouth, but like I'm a ghost boy and stuff. And then you have to go to school the next day. Like, I'm sure that led to a lot of issues.
Yeah. And he was, like I said, he didn't exactly have the shining personality. Maybe he got out of that or something. He looks like kind of like a real estate broker or something.
Yeah, no, he's definitely dressed very nicely. And like I said, he's just trying to do his best now. He's been clean for a while. Like, I don't know about clean, but he's been kept his nose out of police trouble, you know, for a while. So I think he's just a guy trying to do his best. But yeah, that's.
Yeah, he got definitely. But I mean, it's yeah, almost a decade has gone by since he's had any type of law problems. And I hope that, you know, he was able to kind of. Stop seeing ghosts.
I did find the minor in possession charge to be funny. Play on words.
Possessed. Our next story takes place in the birthplace of Michael Jackson.
Gary, Indiana.
But it has nothing to do with my... Oh, man. As soon as I learned that the Jacksons were from there, I wanted to live in Gary, Indiana.
Oh,
and
hell no.
Believe it or not. Yeah, I don't know much about Gary, Indiana. Yeah. But, I used to always think it was like Little Rock, Arkansas, because I always think of these places as like, you know, the birthplaces of music, like mm-hmm. Stevie Wonder. But you can, for about $200,000, you can get a really beautiful house in Gary, Indiana.
Yeah, but from what I understand, it's all the wrong side of the tracks in Gary, Indiana. Maybe something's changed, but, you know, there's a very famous Gary, Indiana song from Music Man, so I always perk up when I hear Gary, Indiana, but it is not the place to live. So... A lot of this info comes from NWI Times Online and Vice. And oh, does this one get crazy. So we're in September of 1997. If you guys want a fun drinking game, reenactment Marge does not want to kiss the reenactor. And he tries to kiss her several times. And she like abruptly has to turn and like give the cheek or the ear or whatever. And it's just hilarious to watch. So
it's the kissing episode or something.
Yeah, it is. It's the kissing people that might not like give their consent. So Margie Jelovic is missing, and the reenactress is actually Jill E. Alexander, who you might recognize from a bunch of commercials. She's in Silicon Valley. She's also in Mad Men for a few episodes.
No, I watched Mad Men. She does look super familiar. She's a beautiful girl, mm-hmm. and she totally does not fit this part.
No.
But I think, you know, as an actress, she did fine. You know, she did great.
You got to get those checks. You got to get those SAG checks. So yeah. Her sister, Nadine, is the one talking to Unsolved Mysteries. So Nadine goes to Margie's house, and Margie left almost everything behind, including her inhaler, which apparently she really needs. So even her car is at the house, and her family thinks that maybe this is foul play.
Yeah, and Marge had a pretty crazy year. She had recently been married, before that, she'd been playing violin in the Detroit Orchestra, or Detroit, which is the actual way you pronounce Detroit. But Detroit Orchestra. So she was kind of, you know, if we're going to kind of put a type of person that she is, she's a violinist in an orchestra. And
dork.
I think we've met people like this. They're dork, they're quiet, they're reserved, maybe they're a bit refined. Mm-hmm. And she met somebody, she was, I'm sure it was a happy marriage. And she got married to Nasser, who passed away 6 months later in a terrible car accident.
Yeah. No, it's so sad. And when somebody dies 6 months into your marriage, there's no getting over that. I mean, they died at the height of who you saw them as a person. You know what I mean? Like, you could not have been more in love with this person.
And yeah, you can't replace that relationship. Yeah,
yeah, they're on top.
As soon as I heard that, I was just like, oh, that's just the worst. You know, it's like it doesn't get too much worse than that. Margie just kind of did what many people would do, and she needed to make a tremendous change. So she quit her job as violinist. I would like to know what a violinist makes in an orchestra, by the way. Mm. And she left Michigan, and she moved back with her mother, and mother and sister in Gary, Indiana.
Yeah, she moved to be close to them.
The Jacksons.
She actually lived in Crown Point, which is about 17 miles away. But, you know, her mom had this like little tavern that she ran. And so she left to go work there. The tavern's called Milan's 51st Tap in Gary, Indiana, which is now Chila's Tacos and Cervezas, which sounds delicious.
But I took a picture. Well, I have a picture of their receipt, and they don't have the most sensitive cartoon character on their receipt, but whatever. You know what? I'm comfortable with it, and I bet you if the beers are really that big and the tacos are that big, I'm going to order two.
Honestly, it sounds good. And so she's like, she's working there. She needs some comfort. She needs to be around people she knows. So she's working at the tavern. And here's where she meets Outlaw's regional boss. The Outlaws is like this biker gang, Randy Mad Jaeger. Mad's his nickname. And she is just like, ooh, he seems dangerous. And she's like smitten from the beginning.
Now, right off the bat, we see the actor and we see the real guy, right?
Yeah.
Who is better looking to you, in your opinion? I thought the other guy was cooler looking and more refined. Yeah,
no.
He's my kind of guy.
When the actor was smiling at her, I was like, I'd let him kiss me if I was the actress. Like, he's cute.
I don't know. Maybe he smells like menthols and like too many mints.
You know, I'm not out. I'm not out. I'm still with
him. And tacos.
Oh, so, my God. Perfect.
Beer and tacos. It's like a romance. So... So I was more towards the real Randy than I was fake Randy.
Fake Randy, you know, he's okay in my book. But real Randy is an ex-con with this huge criminal record. Bad guy, bad stuff. And he and all the other outlaw members were under federal investigation for like racketeering, drug dealing, murder. They had recently just murdered an elderly couple by stabbing them in the throat with a screwdriver.
I mean, I think that the U.S. Marshal, that was his example to say, look, these are monsters. And he had that uncomfortable laugh. Not that he's finding it funny at all, but it's kind of like there's no other reaction really to have than they stabbed an elderly couple in the throats with a screwdriver. You know, it's...
You will often hear that laugh on this podcast. We do that laugh quite a bit because it's just like, whoa. It's like, it's unhuman. It's crazy. But
it is. It's
of
definitely...
course, Margie's like, ooh, he's a bad boy. I bet I can fix him. And they start dating. So the family said that she's getting like real distant and it has to be that evil Jaeger's fault. I do think that this family tends to idealize her a little bit. And I feel like she can't do anything wrong in their eyes when, frankly, I think she has a lot to do with this.
I do, too. I just think that they see her as the nerdy violinist in the orchestra forever.
Yeah.
The bad lady. Not the bad girl.
Yeah, riding on the back of the motorcycle and getting kissed on the ear by her guys. So 3 months after they started dating, Margie and Jaeger, they go on a trip to Vegas. And mid-trip, a bunch of the outlaw members start getting arrested because they are indicted by a federal jury in Wisconsin. So 17 of these like gang biker guys were arrested in total for bombings, robberies, and 6 murders. And the marshals can't find Jaeger because he's in Vegas with Margie. So Margie's sweet little old mom, Katie, is reading the newspaper one day and she sees Jaeger's face on this like list of wanted men in the for what they're indicted for. And she said on Unsolved Mysteries, like, oh my God, I cannot believe my daughter is with this man. Like, oh, that must have been so scary for her. So.
And she started becoming paranoid too, which I would imagine was legitimate, right? I mean, she should be paranoid.
Yeah. The FBI traces them to Vegas, but by that time he and Margie are tipped off and they're kind of on the run. So she arrives in Gary, Indiana 2 weeks later, and they say she is a changed person. She barely speaks. She is so paranoid that everything around her is bugged that her sister said in a newspaper article that Margie wouldn't even speak to her at her apartment. She would write things down on paper and then burn the paper afterwards. That's how paranoid she was that she was being bugged.
Now, what do you think about what I wrote here, which was, do you think that she was like, enjoying the drama and the attention that all of this craziness was, the chaos, because this is a complete 180 from her life just 1 year ago.
Yeah, I'm sure, you know, I'm sure something probably snapped in her when her beloved husband, right. when she was doing everything right and her beloved husband died. So why not take a walk on the wild side if life just sucks anyway, you know? So I do think that probably she was showered by attention by this, like, big mob bossy kind of guy, and that made her just feel super special. She's not exactly who we would call, like, someone who is conventionally beautiful. Not trying to be disrespectful, but I'm just calling it like it is. And she's the guy, she's the one who was picked by the big guy, you know? So she probably did enjoy, you know, her sister and her mom fretting over her. She probably enjoyed being with this guy. And from what I can tell, they had a real relationship. Like, they were very much in love with each other. Jaeger and
they
Margie.
Traveled across, they went across the country to live in our update.
Well, because, yes, spoiler.
But her mom does seem sweet. She's like, we just want Margie home.
Yeah, so 3 months later, in September of 1997, that's when she disappeared. That's when we get Nadine kind of walking through her apartment and finding her inhaler, her car, all that kind of stuff. The only clue that Margie may even be alive is that over the past 4 years, Margie's mom receives several phone calls at the tavern before the tavern opens, and it's just someone, like, breathing on the other end. And so she'll talk to it and be like, Margie, I love you. Margie, you could still come home whenever you want to. My door is always open. And then it just hangs up on her. So her mom and her sister talk to Unsolved Mysteries. They're like, Margie, just come home. We just want to know that you're okay. Just come home. So we have an
update. Now, usually this is where it ends. This is where it's like, well, you know what? She's probably dead, right?
Yeah. That's what I thought.
We never hear from these people again.
No.
But in October of 2014, we learned that they were found living together, these two lovebirds, 2,000 miles away in Mexico, in Rosarito.
Yes.
But the tacos are good there.
Oh, but it was...
Is that racist? I don't know. I don't think so.
I don't think so. I've had...
Either. I like tacos.
It's by Baja California. I've had tacos in Baja California, and they're delicious.
Oh, my
so.
God. California tacos, Southern California tacos, and hamburgers are the best.
I know. I'm so spoiled having grown up on them. But, like, how selfish of it is it of her to just let her family think she was dead this whole time?
I do. I get it. But at the same time, I feel... There's so much more to this story than we learn. I mean, I think who knows how they dealt with the death of her spouse? Who know? You know, we don't know if the family is really kind of a bunch of jerks, and maybe she just needed to abandon her life and move on.
I get it, but I'm sure she
said. You know, we have a happy ending, though, don't we? We don't have a happy ending at all.
They're chilling at this bar, okay? Margie and Jaeger are hanging out at this bar. It's called La Maroma, and that's one in Rosarito, Mexico. And apparently, this is their cheers. Like, this is where they go to. They know all the bartenders, everything.
Norm!
And so all of a sudden, all these authorities walk in, and they're like, ah, crap. So they're both questioned. She's let go. She is free and clear, but she stands by her man. So authorities frisk him, and they find a gun. So Margie runs out of the restaurant, speeds home, makes a U-turn sharply to speed back past the bar to see what's happening, presumably to Jaeger. Then her car flips many times over, crashes into something, she's ejected, and she dies. So,
So this is because of the high-speed chase?
Well, a friend at the bar that they were always at claimed that the two had a suicide pact if they were ever caught. And I have seen it as three different ways. I have seen it as the Mexican authorities shot her. I have seen it that she shot herself when the cops were closing in. And I've also seen that she died due to the high-speed chase and the crash. And I've seen the picture. I don't think we'll put it on our Facebook page because it's pretty graphic because you can see her body. But she's laying just outside of her car. Like, and it's crashed into a telephone pole. So I think maybe it was from the crash. She probably was a little having a few drinks and, you know, wasn't buckled up. Her car's flipped over. She's just outside of it. There's like a trail of blood going down. So I don't know what happened.
Can you tell what kind of car that is by any chance?
I'll
take a closer look.
It does kind of look like an Explorer or something.
It's just, you know how like some cars, especially, this is 2014, so yeah, maybe not. I was just thinking, you know, when SUVs were first becoming really popular, they were flipping all the time.
Yeah, but it might not be a brand new car, you know?
That's why. Yeah, it's possible. I need to just flip it and see if I could figure it out. But, you know, if it was like a Geo Tracker or something like that, you know, those flip so easily. And we, you know, the word U-turn, you think you take a fast enough U-turn, you can definitely flip it.
Yeah, but she took a U-turn like 2 miles away at her home. And then was speeding past the bar to see him. Probably wasn't looking. Probably was looking at all the ruckus across the street. And that's when she crashed. We do find out that Yeager was indicted on racketeering and conspiracy and entered a plea for 15 years in a federal prison. 15 doesn't seem like enough for 6 murders and all that. But, you know, federal prison don't play. So,
in the U.S. federal prison.
Right. And in 2015, here we go. In 2015, Randy's brother, Yeager's brother, was found dead in a burning home with his throat slit and his hands tied in front of him. And according to family members, the whole time Randy Yeager has been in prison, he's been calling him up and giving the brother death threats. So if you ask me, maybe the brother turned him in? I don't know.
Yeah, there's so much more darkness to this story, I think.
Yeah. Oh, right. Definitely.
I mean, people are getting killed, you know, 15 years after this woman went missing. You know, it's, I don't know. The whole thing is so crazy.
Now,
I wanted to ask you about the Unsolved Mysteries updates. Now, they were updated to, you know, relatively well. Like, we learned in the Unsolved Mysteries episode that her crash did happen in 2014. I was kind of curious. I wonder how often they update these episodes.
I mean, they have to do it pretty recently. I mean, even in the one that we did with Laura Bible and Ashley Freeman, that was an update that they had from 2018. So yeah, they have to be updated, I'm assuming, as they happen.
And I saw this on YouTube because I find that's the easiest place to watch it. Mm-hmm. I'm sure one day all those videos will vanish, but you can't just upload a new video in place. So,
right.
You know, without losing your account status. So I'm just kind of curious what their plan is for the future and doing updates.
Yeah, I don't super know. Something about that I do just want to end this story out on is they interviewed Margie's mom, and all she told reporters when she found out her daughter died was, "I know my heart is broken, and that is all I know." And she is still alive and kicking at 85. I found Sister Nadine's Facebook. She's a mom. She's doing her thing. So
she looks exactly the same.
Yeah. Somebody on there was like, "Jesus, age woman. Like, what's wrong with you?" So, yeah, you know, life goes on.
Yeah, life goes on. And it's just, it seems like she literally was looking for an outlet to kind of hide all of this grief that she had for losing her spouse.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I don't feel super sorry for her. She was a very willing participant in this, and maybe she was brainwashed by this man, you know, but.
Oh, no, I don't buy that. Yeah.
No, I don't either, because they lived together for like 14 years doing their thing. Everyone thought they were the cutest little couple in this bar. Like, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, and it's one thing, you can go run off with your lover and go run to Mexico, whatever. But, like, you know, let your mom know that you're alive. That's all.
Yeah, I could see that. It's very heartbreaking. But so there's a lot of cold cases here, or just unresolved cases. But we are at the end of the episode. And Kim, thank you so much for all of the work that you put into every single episode, especially this one.
Oh, pleasure's all mine.
I think this is a great episode to throw at somebody if you're like, you want to see some stuff that's really a smorgasbord of unsolved mysteries topics. I think this is a great episode to throw at someone.
Yeah, you know, I always like to throw an alien in there. I mean, really, when it comes down to it, we have 3 murders and a ghost story, you know? So maybe an alien, maybe some unexplained phenomenon, but I don't know. It was a great episode. I was excited to watch it.
Tonight, we have been confronted with an entire catalog of unexplained and unsolved events. Tune in next time as Unsolved Mysteries Rewind discusses another collection of unsolved mysteries. Until then, we can only look and wonder.